Welcome to Honey and the Hex. I'm Tatum.
And I'm Tansy.
And we're a sibling duo exploring the origins, traditions and intersections of folklore and where they lie today.
Each episode will bring you our learnings of myths, magic and mystery by shining a light on the past and how it's not always as distant as it seems. How much would you risk for aesthetically pleasing walls? Just ask the Victorians. Their lust for lavish lifestyles resulted in their swift demise. Today we explore a beautiful but deadly pigment, William Morris's mesmerizing patterns, and the so-called inheritance powder that may have poisoned Napoleon. But what's a little arsenic when you've got a great new colour to sell? That quote comes from colour historian Victoria Finlay, and today we are going to unravel the horrors behind the entrancing, death-inducing pigment that plagued Victorian Britain. So I let Tatum pick this episode.
Can you tell? It's still got some dark elements to it, but it's a...
I thought you were really going to go for something really cute and sprightly, and then it was death by wallpaper.
Yeah.
I was so proud.
Judy, our friend, and who's part of our coven as well, has this amazing book. It's so beautiful, called Bitten by Witch Fever. And I was just like looking at the wallpapers and I was like, yeah, I think this can make a good Honey in the Hex episode.
Absolutely. I had the book on my desk and my boss came in at my job and he was opening the book like, wow, this is amazing. He was like, I'm going to cover all my walls with this wallpaper. He was getting some really good ideas. So yes, let's delve into this.
The Victorians had a great love of material things. The more trinkets in your household, the happier you were, which I fully relate to.
Oh, 100%. Give me all the trinkets.
Yeah, like minimalism can do one. I am a maximalist and I'm actually proud of that. Like, I want my trinkets, you know. So they craved beautiful patterns, opulent furnishings and flamboyant clothing. However, this came at a price, the price of their lives.
We've heard it all of our lives. Asbestos in the walls, lead in paint, mercury in tuna.
Can I just say, when I moved into my council flat, the Camden councillor who was like helping with my flat was like, it's great though, because, you know, there's no asbestos in your flat. And I was like, oh, woo, what a win. God.
But there is mercury in the tuna. I got mercury poisoning once from a tuna steak in Portugal, when I was living in Portugal, and I fully went blind. I couldn't see anything. I had to get to the hospital and I was living by myself, couldn't speak Portuguese very well, and my whole body went red apart from like a few patches, and I had the most banging headache ever from mercury poisoning from tuna. Didn't stop me though. I still eat tuna. I am addicted to sushi, honestly. I can't stop.
I remember that was scary.
Anyway, we have been warned. The Victorians, however, used a deadly poison today we would consider unfathomable. But it was used in production of children's toys to treat syphilis and even in makeup. Introducing Tansy's Smoky Eye Special, arsenic. That's right. Arsenic was used in production of everything mentioned and more. Would I risk it for a good makeup look? Potentially. Would you, Tate? Looking at me with zero makeup on. But anyway, look, it's not always fatal. And it also was really fashionable in Victorian times to look pale and sickly. So they would like lick arsenic to look really unwell.
Are you annoyed that you're not living in those times?
I'm so annoyed. I would fit in so well. I have tried so hard to tan. Even when we're in Texas or like somewhere really hot, I do not tan. I wear factor 50 anyway. Even today, I'm basically transparent.
Nice.
Love it.
So, obviously, arsenic is poisonous.
For those of you who don't know, saving lives.
It's a white powder, no taste, and because it was so easy to get hold of, it became a pretty useful murder weapon. It even got a nickname in the 1830s and 40s as inheritance powder, as it was a popular choice for those seeking the demise of a wealthy relative or lover. Also because the symptoms were similar to, well, a lot of Victorian illnesses, such as cholera and food poisoning, it was quite hard to diagnose.
So cholera. I was basically dating this American guy, that comedian that you said was not funny. He probably was listening to this. So yeah, you were very funny. Ha 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 ha. Very funny. Thanks for dumping me. And I took him through like the streets of London on a tour, and like the cholera, the tap where they like found cholera, the pump outside the Jon Snow pub. I was giving him a full tour of that. So Americans, if you want a cholera tour.
That sounds like a perfect date, actually. I want someone to take me to the cholera tap.
I am good at dating.
Yeah.
Just can't get a third one. Look, arsenic played the long game. There are so many stories of arsenic poisonings and really shady shit surrounding the supposedly, you know, medicinal purposes as well. You could use this for, like, you know, the syphilis and all that stuff. But it was dangerous. Like they said, the inheritance powder, you can kill off your relatives. And quite subtly, really. I mean, have you got cholera? Have you been poisoned? Who knows? There are a few stories that we will tell you about, a few poisonings. In 1881, a shipboard romance led to the marriage of 19-year-old American Florence Chandler to a wealthy British cotton merchant called James Maybrick, who was more than twice her age. They settled into a suburb of Liverpool, both had affairs, but Maybrick was violent to Florence and fathered at least five children by a series of mistresses. When he was ill in 1889 and died soon after, his siblings were suspicious and requested a post-mortem. Maybrick was known to take arsenic in low doses as an aphrodisiac, but the levels of arsenic found were significantly higher than his usual recreational activity. A servant claimed that she had seen Florence soaking flypapers in water. Florence claimed that she had soaked the flypapers to get arsenic for cosmetic purposes. She claimed she was in the habit of using an arsenical face cream. This method of soaking papers to dissolve arsenic is a common feature of crime fiction of the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Florence was found guilty of murder and sentenced to death. However, she avoided that and only served 14 years in prison. After her release from prison in 1904, she returned to the US where she wrote a book protesting her innocence and undertook a lecture tour. She died a lonely recluse in Connecticut in 1941.
Better a lonely recluse than with an abusive husband.
Yeah, or in prison. I mean, it was sad because she didn't see her kids again when she left prison. So obviously that must have been heartbreaking for her. Mm-hmm. But I do like that she took a really bad situation and then went on to write a book and go on a tour. Great. Get me on that tour.
Okay, so there was something that made this particular subject attractive to us.
My favourite colour? Is it your favourite colour too?
Black.
Oh, okay, of course. Well, my favourite colour, green.
Green.
I'm so obsessed with green.
It is really nice. And we have green eyes, so recessive gene. And there was a colour known as Scheele's Green, also known as Schloss Green and...
obviously, arsenic green.
Yeah, that's the one. It was invented in 1775 by Carl Wilhelm Scheele, who was a Swedish-German pharmaceutical chemist. Scheele's green is an artificial colourant created by heating sodium carbonate, adding arsenious oxide and stirring until the mixture is dissolved. Copper sulfate is then added to the final solution.
I love that. Just like adding a little bit of honey to my tea.
100%. How copper's your tea?
How strong is your copper?
Please don't put copper in your tea.
I'm very non-binary and I sit in the middle section of that brew line.
I sit
not too milky, not too strong.
I sit in the section of making the tea, leaving it and completely forgetting about it.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so how do we describe this green? It's a...
It's bright.
Sagey.
Yeah, it kind of is sagey, yeah, but then it's a little bit more zingy and it has like, it's not neon, but it has undertones.
It's very like mesmerizing, attractive. Do you know what it is?
What?
One short day in the Emerald City.
It is giving Emerald City green.
It's giving Emerald City vibes.
So Carl Wilhelm Scheele did his concoction and made a beautiful and bright colour.
He also discovered oxygen.
What do you mean?
like discovered the compound.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so obviously people could breathe before, like,
People are out here breathing. Yeah.
People are out here breathing. We probably should have got our little sister Tiger on to talk about compounds and elements, but he did loads of other, he discovered loads of other compounds and elements too. Mm. So what of this colour's connection to wallpaper?
As the mid-1800s hit, wallpaper became extremely popular. It was the icon of the times. In 1834, wallpaper sales were at 1 million pieces a year, and by 1874, sales had skyrocketed to 32 million pieces a year. Before wallpaper, we would see more, you know, extravagant tapestries across mm-hmm. the walls. Obviously, wallpaper was more affordable and allowed less affluent members of society to make their homes beautiful without the high expense.
And this was also at a time where gas lamps were now being used rather than living by candlelight. Love a candelabra though, not going to lie, I would still light my home with a candelabra.
Agreed.
But it did mean that the colours on the walls could be more varied. So if you're lighting by candlelight, you don't really want a green or yellow that in the day with the sunlight would look great. But by night, it would be all dreary and drab and depressing. So people could finally experiment with their homes. And of course, they certainly did. They began to measure their happiness by how many objects and material items they had in their homes. So if you had loads of clutter, jumble, everything, you were considered happier.
This was emphasised by publications informing people of what they should be buying. Household guides and magazines were reviewed over and over. Consumerism had hit. It was also instilled in buyers that good taste was of the utmost importance.
John Ruskin, a leading art critic, ingrained this good taste further by stating, "Good taste is essentially a moral quality. What we like determines what we are and is a sign of what we are. And to teach good taste is inevitably to form character." As I was thinking this, walking up Fleet Street the other day. So I just had to add that bit. He was just like, "I was just thinking this, walking up Fleet Street
random.
The other day." I love walking up Fleet Street. Fleet Street.
We've really turned this podcast into a musical.
There's a market for it.
I don't know how I feel when it comes to good taste. All taste is obviously subjective and I think it can be quite classist. But I judge rich people for their taste because I'm literally like, when you go in someone's home and they've got loads of money and then it's just plain and minimalist and white and marble. I mean, I do like marble, but like, you know what I mean? It's just so...
Yeah, like Kim Kardashian's house. I saw, look, I'm not a Kim Kardashian fan. I just need to say that, but she's everywhere, right? And it was like a before and after. And I was like, fuck, you've really ruined it. And then someone else put, the reason it's so minimalist is because her life must be so chaotic. She must have to just walk into that space and see nothing.
Yeah, that's very fair.
But I mean, some rich people have amazing taste.
Oh, some rich people have incredible taste, for sure. It's not like, you know, not making a sweeping statement that all rich people have bad taste. I just become surprised when I do see that, like, for me, you know, I love having my artwork, I love having my trinkets. Here, obviously, Ruskin saying, you know, it's about it can be an expression of your character. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that when people come in my home, I want them to see things all around me. I know this sounds egotistical, but I want people to see a museum of me.
Yeah,
I want people to get a sense of my personality. Mm-hmm. As much as, like, I don't keep hold of everything. I'm not a hoarder. I will like keep a nice wine bottle that's got a nice label mm-hmm. and then put a candle in it and like reuse things.
Yeah. The Victorians were out to prove they were tasteful. They wanted their jumble of elaborate objects to be on show. Minimalism was nowhere to be seen, let's just say that. And along with it, as previously mentioned, they wanted bright colours on their walls, lit up by their newly instated gas lighting. The brighter the wallpaper, the more exciting the pattern, the more taste and class you would exude. And what better colour than green? Recommended in a Victorian household guide as, I quote, "a colour of repose. The eye experiences a healthy and peculiarly grateful impression from this colour, as opposed to something like yellowish red, which is the preference of petuous, robust men and savage nations."
Yeah, that's obviously a problematic quote.
And it was written in one of the household guides of the Victorian times. So everyone loves green, not your yellow eyes at a full moon, Tates.
Don't tell people about that. It's a secret. So the Victorians considered the more vibrant and deep eye-catching shade, the higher value and more classy you were.
And also a big pro of Shields Green was that it didn't fade. So that's why, as well as its low cost production, it was used in everything. So we mentioned the makeup, kids' toys and other things earlier, but it was also in candles, blancmange, like that French jelly. It was in everything.
Mm. And of course, wallpaper in industrial quantities. The huge jump in wallpaper sales correlated with large numbers of unexplained deaths. But were they unexplained? As we know, the wallpaper was pigmented with our now well-acquainted Shields Green.
SG.
It's not the abbreves.
SG's happening. Sorry, Carl Wilhelm. We're not going to CV him, though. Carl Wilhelm's beautiful green was put in all of the wallpapers of the Victorian times.
And people very sadly died.
Podcast over.
Yeah, that's that. Not only were there deaths from arsenic-laced wallpaper, people also fell very sick. And at the time, no one could work out why. As we said, the symptoms were in line with other Victorian illnesses. So how could anyone know if it was completely related to the wallpaper?
Because symptoms included diarrhea, sickness, headaches, severe stomach pains, dizziness, brain fog. But obviously it was really agonizing death. It was said that people were actually glad to die because they were in so much pain from this poisoning that it was just death was a relief.
It's horrible because there were lots of deaths, but also it's so disabling. So a lot of people from living in these homes were becoming disabled mm-hmm. as well. As the press reported the constant unknown illnesses and loss of lives, the correlation began to become more clear. There was an article stating that a six-month-old child had died a few hours after eating a piece of emerald green wallpaper.
What people weren't aware of is that they were being poisoned slowly. Yes, ingesting the wallpaper would result in a quicker death, of course, but imagine you're in your home every day, you're breathing in the poisonous, toxic fumes, becoming sick, you're in pain, you're basically being killed slowly and painfully by the paper on your walls.
Ironically, we all know the phrase, as safe as houses. Well, the Victorians coined this term. How wrong they were. It was said that there were two leading theories as to how the wallpaper was poisoning the masses. Firstly, dust particles caused by pigment and paper flaking, and toxic gas production.
As a lot of the time, particles from the wallpaper flake off, they then float into the air, they're breathed in, they poison the lungs, and they poison the body. Also damp. I mean, we have damp constantly in today's day and age, so I'm sure it was a lot worse back then, especially with like not as good heating. So the dampening would cause the pigment to metabolise, which would also release the poisonous gases.
Let's not forget the pollution and the cold. There was zero ventilation. No one was opening their windows, so they think that they were keeping the toxins out by closing themselves in, when actually they were just keeping all the poison in with them.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter how the poison is ingested, by breathing it or eating it, you're still being poisoned. It's like doing drugs, you can drink cocaine, you still be in your blood. Yeah, they were just being poisoned, and people just didn't realise what was going on and why they were getting so sick, and doctors couldn't explain it either.
The links were being made. People of all classes were dying mysteriously. Many people had noticed that they had been unwell in their homes and then they take a trip to the seaside and miraculously become well again with the symptoms vanishing.
Dr. Alfred Swain Taylor stated, "There appears good reason for believing that a very large amount of sickness and mortality among all classes is attributable to this cause, which is exposure to arsenical paper, and that it may probably account for many of the mysterious diseases of the present day, which so continually baffle all medical skill." So the connections really were being made now.
And people began stripping their wallpaper and saying they had been healed after.
Because people did know arsenic was poisonous, right? But they just didn't make the connection. But I think back in the day, if you think you've got something on your walls, if you're not eating it, like we said earlier, you don't feel like you're going to be ingesting it because it's away. And it was in so many other things. There was even cases of it was used in aprons, and the mothers would like hold their babies to their aprons. The babies would die of arsenic poisoning. Like, so many deaths happened within these, I think, 2 decades of arsenic being used in everything. And it's just so, so sad. Obviously, these poisons are airborne as well. So, yeah, they would just assume that it was lethal when it was, yeah, ingested only. But, yeah.
And the most famous wallpaper, We've all heard.
We've all heard it. William Morris. William Morris & Co. Still going strong. Our mum's actually like such a big fan of wallpapers. And she used to always, she would take us to these stately homes and stuff. She'd be like, that's William Morris wallpaper. And I was aware of William Morris from quite a young age, really. But a bit about William Morris.
William Morris was born in 1834 in Walthamstow, London, which seems to be where everyone's moving now. So
gentrified. It wasn't even considered London then. I think it was like Essex, but I think it is now. Now it's really East London.
Course. Yeah. So he was born to a wealthy middle-class family. He was a textile designer, poet, novelist, and a social activist. He was considered the driving force in the arts and crafts movement. He was resistant in the era's focus on industrial progress and believed handmade goods to be superior.
Mm-hmm. Morris's wealthy background ensured he would never have to work a day in his life. Jealous. He spent his free time exploring architecture, forests, and his local landscapes, and he became intrigued by historical romance and interesting patterns.
The Great Exhibition, or the Crystal Palace Exhibition, was an international exhibition in Hyde Park running from 1st of May to 15th of October 1851. It was here, as a teenager, Morris showed his distaste of machine-age design by refusing to enter.
Yeah, I heard somewhere like he threw up because he was so disgusted by the machine age.
That's the kind of activism I support.
Fully support it. But yeah, so this was like a purposely built exhibition and like so many people came to that. Apparently, I think it actually ended up funding like the Victoria and Albert Museum and things like that. So it's very interesting if you want to look further into that. But also who went to this was to the exhibition, Charles Darwin, Karl Marx, Charles Dickens, George Eliot, they all went and they weren't sick, so.
That's me going into the Langham and throwing up all over the marble, like, this is so...
Marble wasn't even the worst. The brown things on the toilet.
It was everything except from the marble that was bad, in my opinion.
And no ghosts to be seen. Anyway, back to Morris. He studied classics at Oxford, coming under the strong influence of medievalism. After uni, he became besties with pre-Raphaelite artist Dante Gabriel Rossetti, your fave Tates.
Yep.
Get Christina Rossetti. Edward Burne-Jones and neo-Gothic architect Philip Webb. And in 1861, he founded Morris Marshall Faulkner & Co., a decorative arts firm with those guys. What a collab, hey? The goods became hugely fashionable and highly sought after and influenced the interiors of the Victorian era.
And of course, the wallpapers used the Shields Green pigment.
Morris formed this sort of artist collective and wanted to go back to the handmade ways. He never believed that the arsenic in wallpaper was poisonous. He argued that the doctors spouting the dangers of arsenic wallpaper were Bitten by the Witch Fever, which is the title of Lucinda Hawksley's book that we borrowed off Judy. He did fight for workers' rights. He was a socialist. But get this, I find this a bit shady, and I had no idea about this. His dad, Father Morris, he founded the Devon Great Consols, which was the biggest arsenic producer in the world. And William Morris held shares in this company, which is where his fortune came from. And many of these miners suffered horrific arsenic-related illnesses, including skin lesions, and many also died. So it is interesting, as a socialist and activist fighting for workers' rights, but you have shares in your father's mine that's making you money. It's just...
Yeah, how radical are you if you're doing
that? Yeah, I think he felt really guilty about this.
As he should.
Yeah. So Professor Merag said of Morris, "There is no doubt that William Morris was a utopian idealist whose life was full of contradictions. He was a progenitor of the Green Movement and decried the environmental and human degradation caused by industrial activity. But he was also a successful capitalist who supplied the bourgeoisie with expensive interior decor. He seems to have had a blasé attitude to health concerns. However, we cannot be too harsh on him. He was a product of his time."
Heard that one before, hey?
Yep. William Morris did leave wallpaper behind and concentrated on poetry and activism. Allegedly, he didn't even like wallpaper. Apparently, he was just like, I'm a poet, but he like liked beautiful things. He thought wallpaper was basically for people like that couldn't put more handmade goods on their walls, like tapestries and stuff. So now, can you imagine how livid he'd be? Literally, everyone, you think of William Morris, you think of patterned wallpaper, you know?
Have you read any of his poetry?
No, have you?
No. I might. I don't know if
and
I
all his
know.
Like besties, like the Rossettis and stuff, all like poets and artists. Mm. I mean, look, I love the wallpaper. It's beautiful.
Yeah,
so.
It is. Yeah.
Sorry about that, Willie.
I mean, art is poetry in itself.
100%. Another interesting death, potentially and allegedly, regarding arsenic is...
Napoleon.
Very zeitgeist. Film's just out.
Yes.
I haven't seen it, so...
Has it come out already?
Yeah, it's come out already. But my French friend went to see it and said they like really ruined it. They left halfway through and said Hollywood like fucked up a really interesting subject that they could have done really well.
Oh, but, I'm so surprised. You know what I mean?
But I do like Joaquin Phoenix. For years, Napoleon had horrific and agonizing digestive pain, which led to his death. Although his death is recorded as stomach cancer, many people in France were convinced that the British murdered Napoleon. It was revealed that he'd written only a few weeks before his death in 1821, "I die before my time, murdered by the British oligarchy and its hired assassin." Rumours grew, but there was no evidence. In 1840, his body was exhumed for reburial in Paris. Observers were reportedly shook by how well preserved the body was, and arsenic poisoning was cited as the cause of death. The rumours resurged that the British had killed him, perhaps the guards, or maybe he was poisoned by overdosing on arsenic for medicinal uses.
In the 1980s, a sample of wallpaper from the room in which Napoleon had died was tested, and it did contain arsenic pigments. But it's unlikely that this alone would have been the cause of death. In 2008, tests on locks of his hair, his wife's hair, and his son's hair revealed the presence of arsenic.
It is so horrifically tragic about how many deaths happened due to this arsenic wallpaper.
But we still don't really know the amount of deaths, right? That can't be confirmed.
Of course, because it's so similar to other Victorian illnesses that you can't really highlight which ones were which. And some people even say it might not have actually been arsenic in the war. So, you know, you just never know. But after a certain time, everyone ripped down the wallpaper and it was like, oh, everyone's better. So obviously it was.
And people promoting when they were putting wallpaper out, when there had been a bit more of this conversation and a bit of a movement, even though a lot of these companies were in denial and would really gaslight people.
Even company owners were like, oh, it's not poisonous. If you want, we'll put it in our mouths. We'll put wallpaper
it's
in
like
our mouths.
Like Obama drinking the water in Flint. Ugh. Oh my God, I hate people. Anyway, they would start promoting their wallpaper as arsenic-free.
And then it's all of a sudden arsenic-free wallpaper. Yeah. Another way to just be like, yeah. It's the same thing. I used to work in skincare in Selfridges. And at the time, it was like, I think I was 18, it was Selfridges and Harrods. And at the time, parabens were all the rage. Like, it was like, paraben-free this. And one of our cleansers had parabens in it. And they used to just say, you can't say that it's dangerous because parabens haven't actually been proven to be harmful or like a carcinogen. So yeah, you just have to explain that to people. It was just like a trigger word, and actually parabens are totally fine.
So wait, is that true or is that just sliding around the subject?
Got no idea, but I'm
going
to have a look now. I won't name the skincare brand.
Yeah.
It's very expensive.
So, Scheele's Green, absolutely beautiful, but a killer.
But a killer, just like your eyes, Tate's, and just like mine. There's still a book that contains arsenic, which has to be handled very carefully, Shadows from the Walls of Death. You can't touch it without gloves. It was printed in 1874, and it is very rare, obviously. And if you touch it, it honestly might kill you because it has arsenic in it. And it contains around 100 wallpaper samples, each which is saturated with horrifically dangerous levels of arsenic.
Wow.
Yeah. I think it might be at the Harvard University Medical School and the National Library of Medicine, I think. Handle with care.
Well, death by decor. Heading to TK Maxx.
Heading to TK Maxx home section. Heading to, what's the TK Maxx thingy called? Home Sense. Heading to Home Sense.
Yeah. Go get your trinkets, live the maximalist lifestyle, but...
be safe from that tasteless white powder. Thank you for listening. If you enjoy our podcast, please subscribe or follow on whichever platform you listen to your podcasts on.
If you want to support us, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, and you can follow us on Instagram at Honey in the Hex.
If you have any of your own folklore stories, we would love it if you would share them with us. Until next time, Coven.